It's Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Wolforth. I grew up here in Anchorage, and I remember when they used to blow off the air raid sirens because we were preparing for a Russian attack. I even remember when they blew off a huge bomb under Anchitka Island, and they made us get under our desks at school because they thought it might start off an earthquake. This is real. This was happening here. And in fact, the Cold War is one of the main reasons Anchorage is a city of its size, and most of the growth that happened in Anchorage happened because of that Cold War spending. So that's our topic today, except we're going to focus on the coolest aspect of it, right? Which is the espionage and the spy versus spy aspect and the security aspects. Because there's a big conference coming up focusing on Cold War history. Some very important people are going to be here in Anchorage. And I've got three fabulous guests to talk about it today. Ed Strabel is a veteran from those days. He's coming to us from the Valley. Thanks for being with us, Ed.
Oh, great to be here.
Allegra Hamer is with the Alaska Association for Historic Preservation, working on putting on this conference, this Cold War conference that's coming up.
Glad to be here.
And Greg DeRocher has been with me before. He's a veteran from the Nike Site Summit, where there were these missiles that were ready to shoot down Russian bombers, and part of your job was to guard those missiles, and which is a big part of Anchorage history and sort of has really become integrated into our past.
All right, and glad to be back.
Yeah, thanks for being with us. And we'd love to hear your Cold War memories. I think everybody had a different response to it, a response of dread and fear, but then also of incredible growth. And maybe you know something about the security and the all that stuff that was going on in those days. Anyway, we'd love to hear your calls. If you're in the Anchorage area, the number is 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Statewide, the number is 888-353-5752. And if you want to reach us by email, hometown@alaskapublic.org. hometown@alaskapublic.org. That will come to me right in the studio, and I'll read your questions or comments on the air. So, Greg DeRocher, you were... Well, let's tell people what the Nike sites were. First of all, there are three of them: one at Goose Bay, one at Kincaid, what we now call Kincaid Park, and one up in the mountains. Right?
That's correct. Yeah, the Nike Hercules missile system. They were designed to encircle critical infrastructure for the military, and if there was a city in there, they were beneficiaries of it. But it wasn't here because of Anchorage, nor was were the sites around Fairbanks there because they particularly like Fairbanks. But there was a strategic missile bases there. It all had to do with the Cold War. And the Nike Hercules missiles, there was a lot of them, and they were designed to short range. They weren't ICBMs or anything, but they're short range, and they were designed, like you said, to knock down the Russian bear bombers as they came over, basically.
And this, I guess we got the second generation of these missiles, and as I understand it, they were sort of a proximity weapon. They're very fast, 3,500-mile-an-hour weapons, but not super accurate. So they just had to sort of get close to the target and then explode a nuclear device in the atmosphere to knock down the bombers, which, from our perspective, sounds crazy.
You wouldn't want to live in Homer if something went off to knock down a bear bomber that was 5 miles above you. I suspect they would have been effective.
Yeah. Well, it goes back to this thing that there's a real belief that we were at war. I mean, we talk about Cold War now as sort of just an era, but there was a real belief that we could be attacked and we had to be ready. And did you feel that as a service member?
Yeah, it was a war. I mean, there wasn't a lot of them, but people, you know, the spy versus spy things, or there was, our guys would, you know, get captured and we'd trade on the bridge at midnight someplace, and we'd trade one of our spies for one of their spies. And, you know, we had people dying and Gary Powers was shot down. He could have been killed. I mean, that was all part of it. Vietnam proxy war. I mean, how many people died because of Korea? How many people died? I mean, it was a war.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then almost turned into a world-destroying world with the Cuban Missile Crisis and I guess preparation for them coming over the border and everything else. Yeah. So what was your job there at the site? What did you do that in terms of the security?
I was 95 Bravo Romeo 3. I was a MP security guard, and We had different stations. We had the sentry stations for stationary posts. We had roving patrols. There was dog handlers. There were dog handlers. And all the sites had these same things. So roving patrol, you roved around for maybe 4 hours at a time, got a break, then you went back roving again. Good exercise at 80-mile-an-hour wind and 20 degrees and blizzarding. It's not very fun.
You were up on top of the mountain there by Arctic Valley?
That's where I was stationed, uh-huh. 2.5 years.
Too bad you didn't get to be at Kincaid Park. That would have been a little better, huh?
I heard their duty actually included going out on the flats and duck hunting.
So were you anticipating that there could be like infiltrators, people who maybe were trying to get information about the site, or what did you get up to that level to know what it was you were looking for?
That was kind of drilled into us. We had various, and it all depended on commanders. We had a commander that he decided that any rock larger than 6 inches in diameter was a potential device behind which an enemy could hide. So we had to take the deuce and a half trucks and load every rock. And we're on the top of a mountain, mind you. We had to load every rock that was larger than 6 inches across into the back of the truck and throw it over the fence.
Wow.
A lot of us worked for, and that wasn't just the MPs. It was everybody that he could get to do it. We threw a lot of stuff over the side of the mountain,
running around with a ruler. Yeah, Ed Strabel, you were working out in rural Alaska, out in the Bering Strait, right? And doing some. Tell us about what you were doing during those years.
I was actually stationed out of Anchorage with the 207th Group, Scout Group, and but I worked extensively with the 1st, 2nd, and 3rd Scout Battalions, which were based out of Nome, Bethel, and Kotzebue, respectively. And the focus of, I guess, our talk today, the area that was a hot spot for us, was out on St. Lawrence Island, and I had an opportunity on numerous occasions to spend time out there at Gamble. In fact, I never made it to Savunga. I made it to Gamble, though, several occasions. And it was interesting on out there. They would find stuff either washed up on shore or surprisingly well above high tide line. In fact, probably the most interesting item was a light bulb that was found it was up behind the village, about 300-foot elevation on a flat area. And it had Cyrillic writing on it. It was a large light bulb. And nobody could figure out how it could possibly get there intact. It wasn't broken at all. It had Cyrillic writing on it, which indicated it was probably Russian. But
So interpretation is some kind of Russian unit, some special force or spy was landing there and doing some operations.
fell off his plane. But it was a large light bulb. It was probably the type of thing that would be, mounted on the wing of an aircraft for marking. But it was tested, and it still worked. So the shock of landing, if it fell on out, wasn't significant enough. I mean, it could have been right after some fresh, soft snow that fell on out. But obviously, it had to come off an aircraft that was pretty much directly on over St. Lawrence Island there. And if they don't come in low and slow, they probably not get picked up by radar. The other item that was found was a chemical treatment kit, and they thought it, based on the description, that it was something new and modern. However, they sent it back to the lower 48, and it turned out to be an old one. We used to somewhat jokingly call St. Lawrence Island Fantasy Island because of some of the strange things that would occur out there. There's numerous times that the villagers would be on out fox hunting, find footprints with mucklucks or any type of normal boot print that they'd have, and it would go from one section of soft snow to into some hard stuff where they couldn't track it, windblown snow. And the speculation was that this was Soviet Spetsnaz teams that were training on St. Lawrence Island for possible use on the mainland at some of the possibly knocking out long-range radar sites. But
we found out after the Cold War that the Russians had really massed large amounts of personnel and equipment on their side of the barracks, right? So it's perfectly reasonable to think that they were probing.
It could have been. It could have been. We were never able to document anything like that. I mean, the footprints, you know, got to be on out there hunting and see the footprints, you know, note them, follow them, they disappear, and, you know, nothing, you know, the report, but nothing was ever really, really confirmed on any of that sort of stuff.
So were you out there essentially as a scout, Ed, to sort of find out what was happening and to be eyes and ears?
Well, I was a lieutenant colonel at the time, but I had former ranger instructor, but all my junior advisors that were out there were all aircraft or helicopter pilots, and most of them were not infantry, so I used to go on out there and basically train the scout teams in patrolling operations, intelligence gathering, how to cross danger areas, reconnaissance techniques, that kind of stuff, how to report. And the pilots would basically keep us supplied with food and transport people on in for different training exercises.
So the scouts, for those who don't know, were these units that were created during World War II by Colonel Muktuk Marston. And the idea was Alaska Native people were out in the bush. They knew more about getting around or what was going out there than anybody else. And so they could be the best first line to find out what was happening. And so you were kind of an updated version of Muktuk Marston, I guess, right, keeping that program going.
Yeah, that's probably a stretch, but it's, you know, keyed down substantially from what he did, because, I mean, everything was pretty much set on up. All these folks that were in the Guard at the time had gone through their basic and advanced individual training, and now we were into basically unit training. So I was basically trying to train the units. And it wasn't the type of thing where they, you know, Muktuk Marston basically had to start from scratch and issue weapons and conduct marksmanship training. Admittedly, those guys were mostly excellent shots, and the big thing was that they could survive on out there with minimal support. And it was recognized that if anything did happen, they weren't probably going to get any support.
Right, and they would be the first people to run into whatever was happening. I read Muktuk Marston's book, and there's a great bit in there where he talks about bringing the scouts in for marksmanship training, and they all took the marksmanship test and won the highest award for marksmanship sort of in the beginning of the class, and asked, you know, had there ever been a unit where every single member had won the highest award, and he said, no, they'd never actually seen that before. So I thought that was a really good statement about the quality of the guys that were out there sort of defending Alaska.
They were really excellent at their task, which was really observing and reporting and surviving.
Mm-hmm. And tell me, you know, I asked the same question of Greg, but I think there's a sense that, oh, well, this was all sort of playing at war. This wasn't real. But, I mean, it sounds like it felt pretty real to you guys at the time.
Oh, it definitely was. We knew that the Soviets would probably try to knock out the long-range radar sites. And even though we did have satellite coverage, if they come in low and slow, the long-range radar sites, which would basically pick things up as it would come on over the horizon, would be the things that would basically be the tripwire and let us know that they were coming, whether it was bear bombers or anything else. And if they could knock those on out, that would give them basically that knock out our eyes and ears. So the scouts were basically supposed to defend those, secure them, and try to detect and destroy the Soviet Spetsnaz team, which wouldn't be an easy task for them.
Right, because those would be highly trained sort of special forces teams coming in to destroy those the technology in which billions and billions of dollars was invested. Yeah. Oh, it's a fascinating topic. Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Wolforth. We're talking about Cold War secrets today. There's a major conference happening in Anchorage talking about Cold War history. The Cold War was really what gave Anchorage its place on the map. All these investment that took place. Some took place in World War II, of course, getting started the construction of Elmendorf Air Force Base, but then that was drawn down. And it was really with the Cold War in the 1950s that the huge increases in investment and growth of Anchorage took place. In fact, during those years, military spending in Alaska comprised 75% of our economy. So almost hard to even imagine that kind of dominance of one thing. So now there's a conference that's taking a look at that. We just heard from Ed Stable, who is a veteran from those days and is now in the Mat Valley. Greg DeRocher, who's a veteran of the Nike Site Summit, where missiles were defending around Anchorage. And now Allegra Hammer is with us. She's with the Alaska Association for Historic Preservation, which is helping put on the conference. And Allegra, tell us about some of the events that are taking place. I know the son of Nikita Khrushchev is going to be here in Anchorage.
That's correct. Sergei Khrushchev, who is a professor of economics and history in Brown University, is coming to speak about specifically what he calls Cold War warriors, Eisenhower, Kennedy, and Khrushchev, his father. He assisted his father in writing a number of books about that period as well. So he's got a very good handle on the period. He was born in 1935, so he was already an adult. An adult when this was all going on. So he has a very good sense of this. We are really excited about having this. It's going to be at UAA, mm-hmm. At the Wendy Williamson Auditorium, and it is not yet sold out. And thanks to the Alaska Historical Commission, students, teachers, seniors, active military, and veterans are all invited to register and come for complimentary, which is just a wonderful opportunity, especially for the student community. We are really excited about getting students who didn't live in this period at all to get it's from history books. For me, when I was in school, it's like reading about the Civil War.
Right.
And they are reading, about a period that mm-hmm. their parents lived through or their grandparents.
So those who don't know who Nikita Khrushchev was, he was the premier of the Soviet Union, and he was the guy sitting across from John F. Kennedy when the biggest crisis of the Cold War happened, the Cuban Missile Crisis, and they came very close to pushing the button.
Yeah, this was a very scary time. I was a freshman in high school mm-hmm. during the Cuban Missile Crisis, and I was in New York. And, of course, we were blissfully naive of anything going on in Alaska. New York was obviously a target, mm-hmm. and so we were very scared when that happened. It was probably my first realization that we were very, very close to a nuclear holocaust. And I remember going to school that day, my parents sending us off, because you couldn't stay home in those days. So mm-hmm. My parents sending us off, we didn't know if we'd ever see each other again. We really thought it was going to be the end of the world.
And some of the people have talked about what was happening since then have said that, it actually was probably within hours of that
mm-hmm.
happening.
Yeah, it was certainly a watershed event in my life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Just facing each other down and really Kennedy was strong, and we praise him for being strong, but in a way, Khrushchev is a guy who kept the world from getting blown up because he backed down.
Yes.
Who is the greater leader, right?
In retrospect, it doesn't matter, does it?
Yeah, well, we're all still here, so I'm glad about that. So when is Mr. Khrushchev speaking?
Mr. Khrushchev speaking is 7:30 tomorrow night at Wendy Williamson, and there will be tickets sold at the door as well if you can't pre-register. So we invite everyone in the Anchorage Bowl area to come mm-hmm. on out and hear him. I think it's going to be a unique first-person experience for a lot of people.
Yeah. Talk about some of the other events that are open to the public.
Okay. Open to the public, we also have some presentations on Friday morning at the Hotel Captain Cook. Those are very close to being sold out. Some of the military community, Russell Handy, Lieutenant General Russell Handy, Colonel Joe Griffith, and Major General Thomas Katkus, I'm sorry if I mispronounced that, are all speaking in the morning from 9 until 12. And you can still register for those. We have a few spots left. That will be just meetings. And then we do have Robert Wallace. Now, that is a completely sold-out event, luncheon, keynote address, and he's going to be speaking about what your topic is today, mm-hmm. is the spies who went into the cold.
Right. So then in the title, Robert W. Wallace, he was the director of the CIA Office of Technical Services and author of Spycraft, The Secret History mm-hmm. of the CIA's Spy Techs from Communism to Al-Qaeda. And is already here today, but unfortunately we couldn't get him on with us. But we are going to be able to hear him Tuesday the 9th His address to the World Affairs Council will be broadcast here on KSK on our Addressing Alaskans show. Yeah. So tune in for that next Tuesday at this same time, 2:00. We'd love to hear from you about your memories of the Cold War, how it might have affected you. I know a lot of folks like me were here and maybe had to hide under desks, or maybe we have veterans in the audience who could tell us about what they did during the Cold War and how they contributed, or perhaps you have questions for our guests. The number here is 550-8433. From outside Anchorage, there's a toll-free number, 888-353-5752. So the number within Anchorage to get on the show is 550-8433. And you can email us at hometown@alaskapublic.org. Allegra, tell us about Mr. Wallace and sort of what his experience was in terms of sort of the spy craft. I mean, is that, do you have some sense of what was going on here with the spies versus spy part of the Cold War?
You know, I really don't. Read his book, but it was, what I do find out that the Office of Technical Services was a very interesting period and how it's changed. And he's going to talk, I think, a little bit about what it was like here in the Cold War. But now, in the information age, and he talks about this in spycraft, mm-hmm. big time, about the differences in what is necessary in both the people that are working in Office of Technical Services and in their expectations of how they can remain secret in the world. Mm-hmm. Because it's a lot harder to remain secret now.
Right.
And I'm looking forward to his talk as well.
The technology change is huge. Yeah. I mean, to deploy the technology to create essentially a line around North America where we would know that if missiles or bombers was coming in was a huge task that took just an enormous amount of money and manpower, which you wouldn't need today at the same level because our technology is so much more advanced. Right. So... now there's also a reunion, right? Tell us about that.
The Nike, this conference is being held in conjunction with the Nike Veterans Reunion Alaska, Nike Veterans Reunion, which is held, it was held here 5 years ago. It's about every 5 years, I think, up here, because this was a substantial Nike site. We have at the moment 68 veterans, many of whom are still in Anchorage, like Greg. But we also have veterans coming from Maine and Georgia, Wisconsin, New York, upper state New York, all coming to Anchorage starting tomorrow. They are invited to all the events for the Cold War Conference, but they also have some special commemorative events for themselves, Jay Baer is actually mounting a commemorative event for those people in, correct me, Greg, B-Battery? B-Battery was Nike Site Summit. So they're doing a commemorative event there for all those veterans. And then we're also doing something which is also open to the public, what we call the Swords into Plowshares Tour and Commemorative Event down at Site Point, which is now Kincaid Park. And the 1964 earthquake had a devastating effect on that Nike site that was there. Mm-hmm. And the soldiers that were serving there were given a meritorious conduct. Unit citation. I'm sorry. I'm not a veteran, so I don't know these words. We were going to be acknowledging that.
Because of the danger that they were dealing with these missiles in an earthquake.
Earthquake alone. They're going to be a presentation on that. Kempel,
mm-hmm.
the Olympian, is going to be making a presentation there, and we are also unveiling some special interpretive graphics of what went on there during the Cold War.
Oh, great! Such a popular spot.
Yeah, the public is invited to that. The ceremony is at 3:00 on Friday.
All right, we have a caller now, Chris. You had something to share about the Cold War?
Yeah, this is Chris, and I grew up downtown Anchorage on 2nd Avenue, and we had a free-ranging dog, and one day he brought home a camera that was somewhat chewed, but still had functional pictures on it of military sites. We never found out whose camera it was, and it seemed like the places depicted probably weren't ones that anybody wanted pictures taken of unless they had some military interest in the sites. So we always figured it was our own personal, our spy story in the family, and that this dog had brought home evidence of what was going on really on a daily basis, because in the schools we were always practicing our civil defense drills, and the horns used to go off in Anchorage at noon on the civil defense drills.
But you're the only person I know who had a spy dog.
What?
I said, but you're the only person I know who had a spy dog.
Yeah, well, he, I had no idea what he had to do to obtain the camera. He was never very obedient or good at fetching anything else we wanted him to, but he did bring us a very nice Leica expensive camera.
Oh, my gosh, with Russian markings, perhaps.
Yeah, well, we were never sure, but my father was always very intrigued by it.
Yeah. So, yeah, and I recall also the sirens going off, and that sort of became part of a routine of life here, is so the civil defense preparations that we went through as kids, which, you know, did you find that, you know, Peter Dunlap Scholl did a little film about how sort of the feeling of dread that went along with that. Did you ever have that feeling of fear that went with it, or is it just routine in your memory as a kid?
Well, we were certainly very aware, and yeah, I would think there was some dread. We didn't feel that the Russians were out to do us any good, certainly.
Yeah, that's right. All right. Well, thanks, Chris.
All righty. Intriguing program. Thank you.
Yeah. And for others who have Cold War memories of any kind, the number here is 550-8433. We're talking about Cold War secrets and the conference that's coming up. And Greg DeRocher is in the studio. He's a veteran who worked at Nike Site Summit up on the mountain there by Arctic Valley. Greg, before, as we were talking before the show, I was saying, well, there are nuclear weapons on these nuclear warheads on these missiles. We know that now. And Allegra talked about, you know, the missile batteries that were here. But at the time, that was never acknowledged. It was sort of like what's really here was a secret.
Yeah, it really was. And as far as I know, I'm still neither going to confirm nor deny because I have never been cleared. But
So you knew.
You
can't confirm or deny if you knew. Okay.
Yeah.
We're going to take that as a yes.
interesting thing about the cameras. We, in the course of doing our security roving patrols and stuff, Arctic Valley is blueberry picking, as everybody knows. And even though there were signs all over the mountain on the military side, saying trespassers, will be prosecuted, blah, 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 people still came wandering up. Sometimes they weren't blueberry picking. They were just curious as to what that fence was for. And we would have to go out and confiscate the film from their cameras and develop it. And then we would return, well, the people from the base would return any pictures that didn't have anything military on them. So if they took a picture of the integrated fire control area, which is at the top of the mountain, or the launch area, which was just above the Christmas star, any pictures of that area would be confiscated. One guy got really frustrated one time. One of our guys, and I was on shift at the time, but I wasn't outside the fence. He asked for in those days, you just wind up the film and hand him the little canister, and then they take it down to the base. But the guy just said, "Oh, you want my film?" And he opened the back of his camera and he just yanked the whole roll of film right out of it and a bright sunny day and said, "Here." So that, a little bit extreme, but he really didn't have any grounds to complain because he walked right past the signs.
I remember those signs. That we had them in Anchorage along the, in Government Hill, where that fuel depot was. And this is like right into the 80s. And they said, no photos, no drawings, no diagrams. You couldn't like set up an easel there. Which seems somewhat ridiculous. I mean, in today's world, we know that satellites can take very detailed pictures. But in those days, maybe the Soviets could get some information by just taking a picture.
Yeah, some of the rules are a little. You know, it's the government. Right now, when we conduct tours up at Site Summit, we take people all over. But they are not allowed to take pictures of the current antenna array up there. And, you know, like you say, it's satellite images with telescopic view cameras, you know, from Rendezvous Peak or something like that. I mean, people can take pictures, but it's just the way the government is, you know. I was kind of behind the technology, I guess.
You wonder if, like, the people who know least about it are the civilians living in town. The Russians probably know the whole thing. Yeah. All right. Well, it's Hometown Alaska. We're going to take a short break and be back to talk more about Cold War secrets and the veterans who were involved. Ed Strabel, who's up in the valley, Greg DeRocher here in Anchorage, and Allegra Himmer, who's involved in setting up this big conference that's happening to talk about Cold War history. When I come back, I'll be giving out the phone number because we'd love to hear more memories or questions from listeners who were here. I know a lot of you are out there. And how it impacted you? Were you scared of the bomb? Did you know what was really going on here? Were you involved in some of these defenses? So we're going to be doing all that when we come back in just 1 minute. And Hometown Alaska continues.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Hometown Alaska on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Wolforth, and we're talking today about the Cold War period that really saw Anchorage grow when we now know many nuclear weapons were stationed here in Anchorage, and we were probably in the crosshairs for the Soviets. Many, many service personnel working here, and it was a nerve center for the defense of North America. These major communication and radar installations and air defense installations, which were all over Alaska and the western and northern coast, were controlled here and had a really important function nationally. So that history is now being celebrated and studied, and there's a major conference coming up to talk about it. And we're talking about it today on Hometown Alaska. And we welcome your memories, your thoughts, things that you have learned or that you experienced during that period. The phone number here for the show is 550-8433, 550-8433. If you're calling from outside Anchorage, it's 888-353-5752. And you can email us at hometown@alaskapublic.org. Turning back to you, Ed Strabel, it sounds like there was some expectation that there would be some kind of land invasion, especially in the 50s, which I know is way before you were here, and some effort to kind of prepare for that. And you know, I mean, now it almost seems like very improbable now, but I guess there were some objectives that would have made sense if hostilities really broke out, of what Soviet military units might have done coming across the Bering Strait.
From the intelligence that we were given at that time, and I wasn't privy to everything, the primary threat would have been the Soviet Spetsnaz teams to knock out the long-range radar, but the feeling was, on our side of the fence, was that Alaska would be something that the Soviets would probably want to avoid going through and try to hit the mainland, or lower 48 primarily, but eventually they would go ahead and want to land troops in Alaska, but that would not be an initial target other than the knocking out of the radar sites with the Spetsnaz teams, or it could be missiles or bombers.
Right. They wouldn't be likely to send, like, armored columns across the tundra. That, it's hard to imagine how that would ever work. And
no, they'd hit it and bypass it.
Right, right. Although in a strategic nuclear war, I guess you kind of have changed all the rules, the war could be over in a day. And so hitting hitting those radar sites would be really important.
That's correct. That's correct. The one interesting thing that I haven't mentioned so far was the Soviet bomber flights. We had put together a whole bunch of different indicators that told us when the Soviets were getting ready to put those bombers in the air, and they, of course, fly along the international boundary. And we were pretty successful in that, and our fighter aircraft based out of Elmendorf and Eielson would move on out to either King Salmon or Galena in advance of them launching. And then once the word was that they had launched, they'd go ahead and escort the Soviets along the international border.
Right. It was this sort of cat and mouse sort of probing each side. Yeah, yeah.
And pilots would be taking pictures of each other.
Right. Yeah, it's always like a little bit like a couple of guys outside a bar sort of saying, take one step across that line, right?
That's right.
All right, so we've got a couple of callers that I'd like to talk to. Carl is on to talk about, your grandfather was involved, Carl?
Yeah, this is Carl Wasser. My grandfather was Walter Parker. He just recently passed this summer.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, you know, I spent the last, you know, couple of decades really listening to his stories. It's pretty amazing, both my grandmother and grandfather. But Grandfather Walt was probably one of the longest-standing diplomats to Russia, even during the Cold War. He helped prevent some altercations along the line between Alaska and Kamchatka. It's, the remnants of that era are still with us today. It's a fascinating time in U.S. history as well as world history. But some of the near misses of pilots flying 24/7 in the air along the Alaska coast with bombs, nuclear bombs ready to go, in certain times of our history. Is pretty,
yeah.
Kind of scary thought, but...
And Walt was quite an Alaskan, and I think everybody felt really sorry about his passing because he held a lot of memories that he must have known some secrets. Did he pass all that stuff on? Did he ever write all that stuff down about the...
I think he was just a strong diplomat. And, you know, the end of the Cold War, what he continued that work and with the Arctic Council, creation of the Arctic Council, develop a talks with Russia and putting money into international valuation of the ocean when the whistleblowers from the nuclear subs talked about the dropping nuclear fuel in the Arctic Ocean and the Bering Sea. There is a combined effort by the United States and Russia and Canada to put a bunch of money into research and do a monitoring and evaluating the environment in the Arctic in a cooperation that created a positive impact, in which we're actually still going to be leading to that point where Alaska is going to be really significant in the Arctic Council, with the United States taking chairmanship next year. So.
Yeah.
So that's the legacy of my grandfather's work and diplomacy in the Arctic.
Major, major legacy. Thanks for sharing that with us, Carl.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. And now I'm going to turn to Grant, who has some memories from the Cold War. Grant? Grant, are you with us?
Underworld. And he's an author here in America, and he's just fascinated with the Cold War. But it was like, I'm kind of like younger part of it, and it was like, you know, I remember, you know, people telling me, well, the way it happens is if we fire and they fire, then nothing exists anymore. You know, it just blows up the entire world. And so we were terrified of it. And then one of my friends says that's why the Gen X generation has kind of a laissez-faire attitude, because we were just, you know, I remember the air raids going off by Turnagain Elementary School when I was little. And it was kind of like common. You know, we weren't even scared of it. But, you know, then now... You know, a lot of people are coming over from the Siberian side of Russia, and you know, my brother dated a Russian girl. His friend is married to one here in Anchorage. My friend's married to a Russian woman here in Anchorage. You know, and then so, but it was kind of, when I was little, it was like they were the bad guys. It was,
yeah, that when,
was
when
it
that,
was
when it opened up in the early 90s, that was quite an extraordinary thing for all of us, I think, to see Russians, and for a while there were Soviets, and then the Soviet Union went away, but coming to Anchorage, and wow, there are people just like us.
Yeah.
So you went to Turnagain Elementary, and that yellow siren was up on top of a platform there at the corner, and they would blow it off. And do you feel like that influenced your outlook on things? I mean, did you feel like you were mentioning, you know, maybe it affected culture a little bit? Do you feel like it affected you?
I don't, but I have a friend that's my same age, and she grew up in the Lower 48, Illinois, and she thinks it did. I just remember it went off, and it went off. That's what happened. This was in the, you know, mid-70s.
Yeah, and certainly you were always aware of it.
Right by the church there.
Right, yep, right. Oh, thanks for calling, Grant. Yeah, I remember the same thing. Maybe we were in the same class. Who knows?
Hi.
So it's Hometown Alaska. We're talking about Cold War secrets today, and Ed Strabel is with us from the Valley, Allegra Hamer from the Alaska Association of Historic Preservation, and Greg DeRocher, who's a veteran from the Nike Site Summit. Greg and Ed, I would like you to weigh in on this thing about the what they call the left behinds, or the individuals who were, we now know, I guess, on a government retainer to be left in Alaska after the Russians invaded, so they could, guys, I guess, be underground. And there was an article that came out just in the last week or two documenting this was really true. These guys were being paid the equivalent of something like $30,000 a year, that if the Russians invaded, I guess they'd be the underground. Greg, have you read at all about that?
I did read that, and I had no knowledge of its existence, and of course, being in the military on a missile base, everything was on a need-to-know basis. I can kind of understand the, you know, when the Twin Towers got run into by the jets, the surge in military enlistment just soared. And I can see, I was cogitating upon it for the last few minutes here, and I could actually see me doing something like that too, especially if you get a little older, when you're 20-something, you don't want to be left behind. When you're 50 or 60, it's like you make a stand, you know. Right. So I can actually understand that people would actually volunteer to do that kind of thing.
Yeah, and they, I guess, were recruited to, from an intelligence standpoint, to be somebody who could send secret messages to headquarters about what the Russians were doing if the Russians had, in fact, invaded and conquered Alaska, which in a way sounds bizarre to us now. But I guess when, you know, they just... they just built an H-bomb in 1949 and exploded it. The Chinese, communists had taken over China. Korea, war had begun. And I've been told that by Vic Fisher, who obviously was here in the 50s, that people actually left Alaska thinking that we could be invaded. You know, we'd been invaded in World War II. Why not? Ed, did you know anything about this Left Behind program, or were there any rumors about it when you were serving during the Cold War?
I just read about it probably the same time that you folks did. Somebody emailed it to me. We had a similar type program planned for Europe also. There was a number of individuals who were stationed in Germany who were very fluent in German or had married German nationals. And there was plans for them to go ahead and basically... instead of evacuating the families back to the state, which they knew was going to be in almost an impossible situation, they would just melt into the population, but yet provide intelligence where possible on enemy troop movements and that kind of stuff. And I know that in World War II was a great example in Eastern Europe and of course France and. In Holland and even in Italy, where there were partisan elements that were fighting the Germans and Axis powers, and they provide tremendous information and that was converted into intelligence with and corroborated by other sources that aided the war effort.
Yeah, I mean, it would seem like if you had the Eskimo scouts out in the villages, you wouldn't really need additional agents who are trained up. But this article I saw sounded like they thought maybe the scouts wouldn't have the coding ability or wouldn't be just exactly what they wanted. And I mean, there may have been some prejudice involved in that, too.
The training that the Eskimo scouts got was pretty minimal. It wasn't like it was later on once the Alaska National Guard really kind of took up the ball from the Alaska Territorial Guard, and they started giving much more formal training. But even then, you're talking about basically weekend warriors, and it sounds like this program was extremely selective in who they chose for this, trying to get individuals that they felt could really provide some good information to them.
Yeah, they're more like spies than they were like defenders.
That's correct.
Yeah. It's Hometown Alaska, and we would love to hear from you about your memories or questions about the Cold War in Alaska, how it affected our state, how it may have affected you or your family. Certainly, Anchorage would be a much smaller town if not for the Cold War. It was the power that built Anchorage during our greatest period of growth, which was the 1950s, and made a lot of the fortunes in Anchorage. There was a huge real estate boom during those years, and many of the famous names in Anchorage come from people who were building houses and businesses and were here during that great ride of the incredible investment that took place. So if you have any memories from the Cold War that you'd like to share, or if you have questions for our panelists, the number here in Anchorage is 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Statewide, the number is 1-888-353-5752, or you can email us at hometown@alaskapublic.org. And there's a bunch of events coming up along with the conference. And I'm curious, turning to Allegra Hamer from the Alaska Association of Historic Preservation, what got this conference going? What was the inspiration for it? Is it just this is important stuff, and we just want to share it and remember the history? Because it wasn't that long ago that people the Cold War wasn't really discussed that much.
Well, I think in part it was, part of it was the centennial celebration for Anchorage, which, as you pointed out, a lot of the growth in Anchorage, that prime period, I mean, we're thinking centennial, but Anchorage obviously is 100 years old. There's several points in its history. So I think in part it came from that. It was kind of a lovely dovetailing with the Nike Vets reunion and the timing. And I think that's probably where it came from. We had it was supported and spearheaded by large part by the Historic Commission, which was under Lieutenant Governor Treadwell, although he was not directly involved because he had other things he was doing, but his office was critical in getting this moving and started, and they partnered with the Friends of Nike Site Summit, which is one of the programs of the Alaska Association of Historic Preservation, and I think it just kind of grew.
And I guess there are some tours planned of the different sites, or are those all booked up?
Okay. Well, the tours that we are doing, the tour of the decommissioned site at Kincaid. Mm-hmm. There's not very many of the buildings. As you know, those buildings were converted to the chalet and a wax place where they wax skis, and most of the others are just remnants. They're just, they're kind of historical artifacts at this point. The tours of Nike Site Summit that we have been able to do, and we've been doing them for the last 3 years, have been very successful. We've been taking up the veterans like Greg and others have been taking interested members of the public up to see what's going on up there. And Friends of Nike Site Summit has been working since 2009 in a cooperative program with J-Bear to fix that up as an historical education park. Although the tours this year are totally booked, we will be doing them again next year. We'll probably in March or so know the dates that we can think about doing them. And if you're interested in getting on the list so you can see what's going on up there at Arctic Valley, if you NikeSiteSummit.net and just let us know that you're interested and you'll get on the list. We'll let you know when we have the dates.
What's left up there to see? What do you see when you go on the tour?
We see the launch control building. We see the dog kennels, which were renovated last, restored, it's stabilized. There's a lot of stabilization going on. And but the dog kennels were restored last year, or at least the framework of them.
And the dogs were for security.
The dogs
at the
were
perimeter?
Yeah. I think Greg yeah. knows a little bit more about that. Uh-huh. Missile launch building is there, and so a couple of sentry stations. And so the idea is to just create this historic park of Cold War, and it's on the National Register of Historic Places.
Yeah.
So we're looking forward to ultimately getting school children up there, older school children. Uh-huh. But as I said, one of the reasons we're so excited about this conference coming out for the kids, and the Social Studies Department of the Anchorage School District has been really helpful in trying to get the word out to the teachers and to the community.
Yeah, well, I know that even at the Kincaid side, when you go down in the chalet, there are these hallways that are not open to the public where stuff is stored, and you see these huge blast doors and these enormous hinges and iron and
it
concrete.
Was one of the launch control buildings, am I correct, the chalet?
The chalet was a bunker.
Was a bunker? Uh-huh. Okay.
Yeah, the chalet and the wax building were bunkers, and then it was a double missile site, so there was actually two other bunkers. You can see that they have the same shape, and they're if you're looking to the north, down the slope, you'll see them up on the west side of the clear area.
Yeah. So, where are you as a MP? Where did you get into where the missiles were stored, or is it sort of like need to know and you only see?
Yeah, and we're talking about espionage and paranoia and everything. Everything was a two-key system, so we would have to do we call them missile checks, but it was actually checking all the doors and stuff. And so it was always a sergeant of the guard would have one key, and then one of us would have another key, and we would check the keys out, and then we had an alarm panel that in the main sentry station called Post 2, and then you'd go in, you'd be radioing, you're going to open a door now, and the locks were huge. You'd not believe it how big the locks were. They're bigger than my coffee cup here. And each one would open the lock, and then you open the door, and the buzzer would go off, and we're testing the integrity of the system. Uh-huh. And then you check the blast doors. They'd roll up and roll down, and then would ding. And once you were satisfied everything worked, you go to the next building and around the perimeter and stuff.
Yeah. So we've got a caller now, Gary, who sounds like he was working there too. Gary?
Hi there, yeah. I just added my two cents here. I was a tech in the early 60s, about 61 or so. I was on the White Owl system, and also I had the communications and all the data links for the Nike battery site controller over on Fire Island that controlled the Nike batteries around Anchorage. And so I was there for about a year and a half, something like that. It was long, quite a while.
Were you a service member or were you a contract worker? Or what was your role?
I was a contract worker. I was working for RCA at the time. I'm from Alaska. I joined up with RCA when I got out of the Marine Corps in the 60s. And like I say, well, interesting side note, the control center over at Fire Island, they had Hughes Aircraft, the electronics division, they had built one of the computers, and there was a monster. It filled two rooms, and they had two full-time engineers working on it, keep it running. And, of course, back in those days, it wouldn't do what my watch would do right now, you know what I mean? It was used for calculating intercepts and everything on it, but they fed all the radar data from the site from the sites, and of course Fire Island had the major radar operations. So
right, well, it was super cutting edge technology at the time, and one of the things that's easily forgotten is there were a lot of contract workers with high tech knowledge that you couldn't necessarily get in a GI, who were here doing this work all over Alaska, and they might not be considered veterans, but they really were doing the important defense work.
Yeah, right. Well, after Fire Island, I went out on the White Alice and worked several sites out there where we worked the 50 kW troposcatter systems to reach out on the chain and everything like that, and then of course. The White Alice was feeding the Dew Line and all of that data and communications.
Yeah.
From there. So it was interesting times in those days. Made awful good money for those times, you know what I mean?
I'm sure. And it was quite a technical achievement, because nobody ever built a communication system out there to do that. Well, thanks for calling, Gary.
I'll enjoy your program. Thanks.
I appreciate your call. And now let's turn to Bill, who had a comment, I guess, about the Vietnam War. Bill?
Yeah, but anyway, I worked for Flying Tigers during the war, and I guess most people in Anchorage don't realize how much we were as a city involved, because Elmendorf during the Tet Offensive and the busy times during the Vietnam War was absolutely slammed flying, you know, logistics over to Vietnam. And I witnessed this myself. There was a guy that got off a DC-8 airplane under military escort from Elmendorf that came over. We parked that airplane at the far end of the airport, which we never did. The same crew flew it in, they flew it out, which very rarely happened. And a guy with an attaché case unlocked it, another guy put it on, they saluted, put the guy on the airplane. I pulled the stairs off. I said, "Hey, what's on that plane?" He said, "What are you doing here? This is a secured military area." And years later, I was talking to a guy. I'd bought one of those orange flight suits that the astronauts have, because I hate those things, because I used to sweat through them. I said, "What do you mean?" He says, "Well, I used to sit on an aircraft carrier in Vietnam with a nuclear bomb on my jet airplane." I said, "What do you think was on that airplane?" He goes, "What do you think was on that?"
Yeah, that's right.
I talked to another guy. I gave him a ride, and he said he hadn't been to Anchorage, same, you know, Flying Tigers, he's a military courier. He said that he was in Anchorage in the 50s, and he worked in biologicals for the military doing something to try to make people sick for 24 hours so they couldn't pick up their gun. He said Anchorage was in a unique position because there was a military base, isolated population, and predictable windage.
Well, thanks, Bill. We're going to have to go because we're just about out of time, but I appreciate your call. And I want to give Allegra just a minute to tell about the talk that's happening tomorrow night, for which there are still tickets available. Allegra, we just have 30 seconds
okay.
left.
Okay, NikeSightSummit.net. You can register for the Sergei Khrushchev's talk right there.
Which is happening tomorrow night.
Tomorrow
right?
night, 7:30 at the UAA Wendy Williamson.
And the talk that's being done by Mr. Wallace, the former CIA veteran, is sold out, but will be broadcast here on KSKA next Tuesday, September 9th. At 2 and 9 p.m., so that's going to be great. I want to thank you, Allegra Hamer, for being on the show and also for helping set up this conference, which sounds really exciting.
Thank you.
Greg DeRocher, a veteran from NikeSight Summit, thanks for being with us. Thanks for your service also defending America. We don't know what the impact of it was, but we're all still here, so that's good.
Yeah.
And thanks, Ed Strabel, also worked out in the bush with the Eskimo Scouts. Thanks for being with us, Ed.
Thank you.
All right, well, that's all for today's show. Next week on Hometown Alaska, you can join host Kathleen McCoy to talk about Alaska's bees. Are they healthy? And if not, what does that mean for the rest of us? Pat Yak is the Chief Content Officer for Alaska Public Media. Monica Gokey is our web editor and audio engineer. Thanks for joining us today on Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Wolford.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.